The words we live by.
The National Broadcasting Company and its independent affiliated stations make free time available to present the Eternal Light summer series, The Words We Live By, a transcribed program which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present another in this series of informal and unrehearsed discussions of selected passages from the Bible. And now we take pleasure in introducing our moderator, Professor Judah Golden of the University of Iowa. Professor Golden.
These informal and unrehearsed discussions on the words we live by are an attempt to arrive at a meaningful appreciation of the problems which the Bible raises, incidentally, not only for scholars, but for every sensitive human being. The regulars at these sessions are Dr. Saul Ginsberg of the Psychiatry Department of Columbia and Professor Abraham Halkin, Associate Professor of Hebrew Literature at City College. Our guest today is Mr. Cord Meyer, Jr., Chairman of the Executive Committee of the United World Federalists. Today's program will deal with the dramatic encounter between an ancient prophet and the high priest of his day. The story occurs in the 7th chapter of the book of Amos, part of which Fred Collins, our announcer, will read for us.
Thus the Lord showed me, and behold, the Lord stood beside a wall made by a plumb line, with a plumb line in his hand. And he said unto me, Amos, what seest thou? And I said, a plumb line. Then said the Lord, behold, I will set a plumb line in the midst of my people Israel, and the sanctuaries of Israel shall be laid waste, and I will rise against the house of Jeroboam with the sword. Then Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, said unto Amos, O thou seer, go flee thee away into the land of Judah, and there eat bread and prophesy there, but prophesy not again any more at Bethel. Then answered Amos and said unto Amaziah, I am no prophet, neither am I a prophet's son, but I am a herdman and a dresser of sycamore trees. And the Lord took me from following the flock and said unto me, go prophesy unto my people Israel.
Thank you very much, Fred Collins. Mr. Halkin.
It's remarkable how eager Amos is to distinguish himself from the other prophets by insisting that he's not a prophet nor the son of a prophet.
Well, I wondered why he felt it necessary to make that distinction.
I, too, would be very interested in hearing some answer to that question.
Well, would you care to take up the term prophet in itself, since I suppose that's where the whole difficulty would arise? Amos says that he himself is not a prophet nor the son of a prophet, and yet he's come down in history as a prophet.
Well, I think that really comes almost from a difficulty Amos experienced in finding a new name for himself. He felt he was different from the others. They were usually professionals, men who were trained in the profession of being prophets, and he saw himself as somebody altogether different.
Mr. Ginsberg.
What kind of training would a prophet have? What do you mean when you say a trained person?
Well, we don't know exactly, except that the Bible, in the Book of Kings particularly, refers several times to the sons of the prophets, and it is generally assumed that they were sort of disciples following the master, learning from him and trying to imitate his ways until eventually they matured and were ready to assume the robe of prophet.
The reason I ask is that I, as a layman, had thought of a prophet as a result of inner conviction, inner strength, and hardly as a result of any training which he would have received external to himself.
Well, I think that, Dr. Ginsberg, you're quite right. The only thing we have to keep in mind is a little bit of history at this point. The men who were prophets before the time of Amos were prophets also, I would say, of inner conviction. Nevertheless, the fact remains that there were such things as guilds. There were such things as training grounds. They went through under the leadership of some prophet, but apparently that often made it possible for individuals who did not have an inner conviction to become prophets. And as a result, I get the feeling that Amos wants, above all, to disassociate himself from that kind of circle. Mr. Halkin.
One might also add that the prophets before the time of Amos, and undoubtedly most of the prophets in his time and after him, were people who catered particularly to the individuals. A man wanted to know what would happen, and he turned to a prophet and asked him. Amos is a man who speaks to the nation. He has no individual messages to convey to anyone. He's concerned with the fate of the people as a whole.
Mr. Harkin, I particularly wondered how Amos achieved this status as a prophet sufficiently powerful to invoke the wrath of the king's counselor, or why, how he achieved that position from a simple herdsman so quickly and apparently so powerfully.
I don't quite know what you mean. Do you mean what preparation he had, or how it is that he became so popular?
How did he become so popular? That was the question.
Well, I don't know that he became so popular. It so happens that we know very, very little about the life of Amos and of most of the prophets, of these literary prophets, that is, the men whose words we have rather than their biographies. And my own guess, Mr. Meyer, is that they were not as popular as you're inclined to think. I'm not sure that they had much of a following, except for the few devoted disciples, some of whom wrote their words down. I imagine that their words were rejected by most of their audiences.
Wouldn't you think that almost by definition a prophet would rarely be popular? After all, he's leading an unpopular cause. He's preaching things which people don't want to listen to, don't want to hear. Often they're unpleasant and impose unpleasant tasks on people. It would be hard to conceive of a prophet really as popular.
Well, what you say is undoubtedly true, and yet, on the face of it, it isn't as simple as all this. The prophet does bring a message which at least the poor and the oppressed in the community ought to accept. He speaks against social injustice. And the poor, who are always the target and the butt of this social injustice, ought to be the ones to be in agreement with him. And yet my guess is that, as you say, even they, for one reason or another, are equally impatient with him and with his remarks.
Mr. Meyer, I did get the impression in reading the chapter concerned that Amos did succeed, however, in getting sufficient strength and having a sufficient appeal to make him a definite threat to the constituted authorities.
I'm not so sure, Mr. Meyer, that he was as much of a threat as we gather from the remarks of Amaziah. Let's not forget that Amaziah acted in the capacity of the king's emissary at the sanctuary, and he probably felt it his official duty to make a report to the king as soon as he heard Amos's words, without stopping to figure out whether they were really presenting the danger that he described them to be to the king.
Would you say, Mr. Halkin, that Amos represented no danger at all? It seems to me incredible that a high official like the high priest Amaziah would himself take the trouble to report back to the king and to the palace the words of a nobody. I don't think that there would be any disagreement with you when you say that Amos as a prophet was probably not very popular and didn't attract enormous following. Nevertheless, one would get the impression, first, from the nature of his words when there are many people suffering, and secondly, from the fact that no one other than the high priest goes back to report to the king, that he must have made more than just a very superficial impression on his day.
Well, potentially, Mr. Golden, he's undoubtedly a danger. A man whom I almost don't hesitate to call a revolutionary in his time is without question a danger to existing institutions and existing views. At the same time, however, I repeat, I doubt that he made so much of a dent in the public opinion as we'd guess from the message sent by Amaziah to the king.
Mr. Meyer?
Well, I wondered if his eloquence isn't perhaps the explanation of his power. In other words, that a great many people, I think, at any time have definite feelings in opposition to the prevailing social structure, but only those who make their opposition known in an eloquent and an effective way get a hearing. And I think that's the problem. The fact that he did get a hearing, and that was what engaged the interest of the king's advisor.
Dr. Ginsburg.
I wonder if we could go back a step. If I understood Mr. Halkin correctly, he was making a distinction between prophets as teachers and prophets as social reformers or revolutionaries. In other words, aren't we led directly here to deal with the problem that had been raised earlier but not considered fully? What motivates a prophet? What is it that leads him to this calling of being a prophet? Because it seems to be something which transcends merely being a teacher. And if I gather correctly, you want to make a distinction between a prophet and a mere social reformer. Is that right?
Yes. I have always felt that the prophet cannot be equated with any of the people that come to mind, such as social reformers or political analysts, Because, so far as I can see it, the latter, both the reformer and the political analyst, always arrive at their conclusions on the basis of analysis, of examination, of probing into the problem, whereas the prophet, so far as I see him, is a man who is driven by some kind of emotional urge. He undoubtedly sees something which displeases him, but without stopping to analyze the whys, he immediately goes on to combat it because of this inner drive, without feeling that he's studied the problem thoroughly.
You're not suggesting, Mr. Halkin, are you, that there was no reflection on the part of the prophet, are you?
Well, I don't know. It's hard to say. Reflection, yes, but not the sort of reflection which we usually connect with the men nowadays who come out with programs and with plans.
Mr. Meyer.
I was just going to say that, Mr. Halkin, that perhaps the distinction you're making is that he didn't have an institutionalized program laid out, and which was to be a panacea if it was accepted. But rather, it was a reaction against long-standing evils rather than a cure that he was proposing.
It may be, but at the same time, I think it's more than this. I can't think of any man in our own day or in recent times who speaks with all the fire, with all the urge that an Amos or another prophet speaks, and it seems to me that these forces come from some source which is much more powerful than the result of intellectual thinking or mental conclusions.
Dr. Ginsburg.
Leaving political analysts aside, who are really crass people, whatever their skills and sincerity might be, it would be very hard for me to conceive of a social reformer who did not have great inner conviction, unless he were a charlatan or a quack. I would think that a social reformer must come very close to a prophet, except in terms of some ultimate motivation at the hand of the word of the Lord. Otherwise, I think you are left with a kind of an anomaly there, because the things that the prophet proposes are certainly very close to things that we consider in modern times social reform.
I think that one of the things that may help us in understanding what would be a difference between the ordinary social reformer and the prophet would be this. A social reformer, let us say, will oppose a specific political structure or a specific economic structure, and then come along and say, I have a better structure to recommend for you. I think in terms of the prophet, it's not a specific structure which he is protesting against merely. Of course he protests against a specific structure. It's not that he has another political scheme which he wants to substitute. He has a calling of a certain absolute ideal. He wants absolute justice. He wants God's justice. He's not saying change political parties. He's not saying change, let us say, from capitalism to communism or from communism to capitalism. He's saying if you're not going to have justice under a capitalist system, that's bad. And if you're not going to have justice under a communist system, that's bad. Justice is the principal thing.
Would he have no conception of how justice might be affected?
Oh, yes, I think he might.
That would make it institutional of itself, then, would it not?
I don't think that he thought in terms of a definite process by which justice would be effected. As a matter of fact, that's one of the distinctions that students and scholars often draw between the prophet and the priest. The prophet speaks in terms of the ideal, in terms of the absolute, and it's left to the more practical people to try and work his theory out in practice.
Dr. Ginsburg.
Well, I see the difference. The person who came to my mind, Mr. Goldman, as you were talking, was Gandhi, who had great inner conviction, great sincerity, great devotion to justice, both as an abstraction and yet who had a concept of how justice could be effected for his people. The point then that you're trying to make is that the prophet had no institutional interest of that kind. He had an abstract devotion to justice, whereas a man like Gandhi had a definite conviction of how the justice could be effected in terms of the people for whom he was concerned.
Mr. Meyer.
But you might say for Gandhi as a prophet that what he actually proposed in terms of a return of India to handicraft work in the small Indian villages was as irrelevant a practical institutional program as any actually that Amos proposed. And in that sense, he was not putting forward a workable program in political terms.
Mr. Halkin.
And I would add that if, perchance, Gandhi's suggestions had been carried out, he would have discovered that the new India was as far from his ideals of justice as the India he'd been criticizing.
But There was another element that brought Gandhi to mind, and that was the loneliness of the prophet, the fact that he really has, or the social reformer, that he has to fend for himself almost entirely, which was true as far as I can make out of Amos especially.
But wouldn't you say that genius almost in every age and almost every expression of human life is going to be lonely from that point of view, Mr. Halfkin?
I don't quite think that it's only genius. I take Dr. Ginsberg's remarks very, very seriously. I think the tragedy of a prophet is really grievous, not only because he's a genius, but because he so distinctly and directly runs against the stream. He protests in every way. And although every person would in one way or another benefit from the reforms that he seeks to introduce, there's undoubtedly a great deal of unanimity on the part of all classes in rejecting him and in opposing the prophet.
Well, if there had been such unanimity in rejecting the prophet, Mr. Halkin, how is it that his words were preserved at all? Mind you, I'm not trying to deny the general truth of your observation, that a prophet is a lonely man, or that the prophet doesn't win a great following. The chances are, if he won a great following at any age, not only in the 8th century before the regular calendar at the time that Amos lived, if the prophet won a great following, he probably would not be of the stature of Amos. It's always easy to swim with the current. But I get the impression from some of your emphases that Amos had virtually no one to listen to. He wasn't popular at all. Amaziah was simply reporting that there was some nobody who came around to make a disturbance, that he sits virtually by himself. Who in the world remembered the words of Amos?
Oh, I don't think that's such a hard question to answer, Mr. Golden. We never expect 100% reaction one way or another, and even if it was only a minority, and perhaps even a small minority, that listened to Amos, there were in this minority disciples of his who took care to write his words down and pass them on to posterity.
Dr. Ginsberg.
I mean, there's another aspect of this which is of great interest to me and I think of great importance, and that is, I think we assume that it is possible to persuade people to change when the change is nominally for their own good much more easily than is actually the case. And I think that's true here. I think the prophet must always have found the way social reformers find, that it is very difficult to persuade people to make changes which are necessary for their own improvement.
I think that is true. There's just one thing, Dr. Ginsberg, that is of concern to me, why you keep insisting when you speak of the prophet, once again, prophets and social reformers, prophets and social reformers. And I think it is very important to recognize that we're not dealing just with a social reformer. Change, I'm sure, is always a difficult thing for the poor, for the rich, for the strong, for the weak. Amos, on the other hand, didn't come, I think, just to preach change. I think had anybody come and said to Amos, would you support a program of change? I don't think he would have answered that question. I think change would have been irrelevant to him. He had a certain ideal which he believed was a permanent ideal for human life. That was what he was after. He was after seeing that ideal realized. He wanted justice in society. He wanted to smash this attitude of the people that so long as they were meticulous in their cultic practices, you know, brought the right sacrifices, said the right prayers, bowed the right number of times, mumbled the right way, that everything was going to be all right. He didn't like that. He felt that true piety represented something else. That's why change is involved here.
But everything you say implies to me change. It's impossible for me to think of reform without change, or change without change.
Mr. Meyer.
I think it's really, you might make the distinction on a temporal basis, that the prophet, in a sense, precedes the social reformer, and only when he is, as you say, Mr. Golden, announced that ideal in sufficiently eloquent and appealing terms that people can go specifically to work in terms of implementing it. And in that sense, I suppose all of the social reformers that have been since the Old Testament have looked back to the prophets.
Yes, I am really asking whether we are right in trying to focus upon Amos, first, as a social reformer, though an exalted social reformer. Secondly, whether we are doing him justice if we're saying that all Amos wanted was change. Inevitably, Dr. Ginsberg, you're going to have change if a man comes out and protests. But I don't think that the principal ambition, if I may use that term, the principal ambition of Amos is to bring about change, Mr. Halkin.
Well, Dr. Ginsberg is nevertheless correct in saying that the reason Amos and all prophets failed in their mission, at least in their own lifetime, is this, that people are opposed to change. And the kind of thing Amos asked for was so radical that it was really a change very, very hard to make. Undoubtedly, when they heard him speak, like any crowd listening to a speaker, they may have applauded and for the moment perhaps even agreed with him. But when it came to carrying these things out in practice, it undoubtedly meant the kind of change which they would oppose.
Mr. Mayor, that raises, it seems to me, the question of what our own reaction, the reaction of our own people in this country would be towards a prophet of the stature and eloquence that Amos himself was.
You mean if an Amos appeared suddenly in our midst, how would we react?
How would
to
we
him?
React?
Well, I'd be willing to venture a guess, especially I'm safe since there's no Amos around that I know of. I think people would be very frightened. I would think they would feel the impact of the challenge very intensely. And we know from much lesser prophets than Amos or his kind that people react often very unfavorably to the very voices which are proposing things which, as I said before, are for their own good. There's an interesting phrase been coined by a psychoanalyst when he speaks of the need to escape from freedom. People are afraid of liberty, of freedom, of privilege, because it requires a high degree of integrity to use it successfully. We often feel that people ought to rebel almost automatically against oppression, against injustice. The fact is that, as any social reformer, no matter how modest, knows, it's very difficult to get people to instrument their own awareness of the injustices that are being wreaked upon them.
Dr. Halkin.
It's just enough to think of all the voices we hear in the press and in the newspapers and in literature and on the air about how sacred our heritage is and how we must remain loyal to it, to realize that if an Amos rose in our day, we'd regard him exactly as the same crackpot and lunatic that he was regarded by his own the people in his own generation.
Which simply would point out, of course, the constant importance almost of listening to an Amos. He remains relevant in the 20th century of our calendar as he was back in the 8th century before the regular calendar. People don't like the things that we read in Scripture, but our likes or dislikes may be sometimes quite irrelevant, Mr. Halkin.
But what saves Amos, it often seems to me, is that he lived some 3,000 years ago and presents no immediate danger, so that we can all read him with a certain kind of smugness, condemn the generation he lived in, and never once stop and think that actually what he condemns is still to be condemned. And it's just our good fortune, if I may say so ironically, that we don't have to listen to him in our own day.
If I may put it this way, Mr. Halkin, what you're pointing out is that people are prepared often to read certain words, but not to live by certain words.
It's yes? Much tougher to live by them than to read them, naturally.
Well,
I'm intrigued as a psychiatrist with this lunatic word. It's an old musical comedy kind of a gag about the people who are considered lunatics, who are very interested and preoccupied with reform, with revolution. And here, as elsewhere in life, I think it's just a matter of degree that separates one kind of lunatic from another. It's perfectly true that anyone who advocates a marked deviation from the accepted will be considered by many people a lunatic. And I guess that's why it requires such a high degree of courage to preach for reform, or certainly to be a prophet.
Mr. Meyer.
Well, that raises an interesting question that I think is relevant. And that is that Dr. Ginsberg, as a psychiatrist, I know that the psychiatrists as a whole use the phrase adjusted often. And I think it would be very difficult to define Amos as being adjusted to any prevailing standard of conduct or way of life. And I often wondered how the psychiatrists would adjust the phrase adjusted to meet and fit people such as Amos.
Well, I think that's perfectly true. It's always been said that genius or the great achievers have been very neurotic or closer to lunatic than neurotic. Whether that is necessary, really, that one must be so sick to be able to achieve change, that's very questionable. But it certainly is a strong motivation, and perhaps it requires just that degree of, quote, lunacy to be able to stand up against the mob of the people and advocate change.
Well, if you're going to be out of sorts with the current of the time, I'm afraid that some form of neurosis is going to be involved. I don't quite understand whether you want to have your cake and eat it too. You want, in other words, to have prophets, but they're not going to be out of joint with the times?
No, I simply refer to, I wouldn't mind that at all as a formulation, but I think it's a little venturesome to assume that A high degree of emotional disturbance, which lunatic implies to me, of course, is necessary as a prerequisite for a person who wants to advocate change.
Mr. Halkin.
But isn't it a good thing for Amos that because he lived so long ago, we can at least see that he was very, very far from being a lunatic, and only in the eyes of his generation was he regarded as such, in much the same way as some of the people who surrounded Roosevelt in 1933 were called brain trusters.
Oh, sure. I think lunacy is a purely contemporary judgment. In retrospect, when we, especially after the reforms have been effected and proven beneficial, then everybody's ready to recognize that they weren't such lunatics after all. But that's a retrospective kind of wisdom.
I'm not altogether happy with this word lunacy, which has been introduced. Incidentally, it was a word introduced, of course, often by the prophet's contemporaries. We're told
in this passage,
yes,
is it not?
Yes, we're told in various passages of Scripture that the prophet is known as the lunatic. They call him that Isham Shuga, the word referring almost to a lunatic or a madman. But I think circumventing a problem or dodging a problem in the way in which we're discussing it. The question is, really, how are we going to have an Amos if we're going to adjust every human being to his time? If we're going to see to it that people are not emotionally disturbed. Isn't it a good thing that Amos
was? I wouldn't worry about that, Mr. Golden. The risk of that happening is so remote, I think we're perfectly safe to assume that if prophets will rise among us, whether they be lunatics or not, the fact that we want to make them healthy and well will not destroy their need to, or their willingness or ability to prophesy.
Mr. Meyer.
I do think that there's something to be said for Mr. Golden's point. How are you going to expect to have prophets arise or expect a prophetic tradition if the ideal is a completely adjusted person?
I didn't want to suggest, Dr. Ginsburg, that we oughtn't try to adjust people to their environment or we oughtn't try to make people happy. As a matter of fact, the very reverse is what I would encourage. But I think we have to recognize, in the light of what we've been saying about the prophet, that the prophet is going to be a man who will be emotionally disturbed by the developments in his own time, that he will be working under a compulsion because of an ideal, and that he will cry out as Amos did.
You have just heard another in the Eternal Light Summer Series, The Words We Live By. Our moderator was Professor Judah Golden, and our panelists were Dr. Sal Ginsburg and Professor Abraham Halkin. Our special guest today was Mr. Cord Meyer, Jr., Chairman of the Executive Committee of the United World Federalists, Incorporated. Be with us again next week when we will discuss the important issue raised by the 8th chapter of 1 Samuel. Let us have a king to judge us like all the nations. Comments from listeners will be appreciated. Our guest next week will be the distinguished editor of the Saturday Review of Literature, Mr. Norman Cousins. Free time to present The Words We Live By is made available by the National Broadcasting Company and its independent affiliated stations. This weekly transcribed program is presented under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America.
Teach your children the rules of highway safety, and above all, remember that accidents don't always happen to the other fellow. The next life you save may be your own. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.